Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Heather Booth, who is Executive Director of Americans for Financial Reform. As we speak to her, they're still debating in Congress what's going to happen to this bill, but a lot has happened in the last few days, and we're lucky to have Heather Booth with enough time to talk to us once again. Heather, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, Mark, it's great to be on this show, and it's right at a moment when, in fact, the American people still can have an impact to pass such significant reform of Wall Street and rein in those big banks, or if we don't take action, I still fear that the big banks will still run over us as they have over the economy for the last couple of years.
Well, talk about that a minute. I mean, what is it, when you're saying at this last minute, that as people are listening to this broadcast, what can they do at this last minute? What are you referring to?
Well, the crisis people really know about quite well, that 8 million people have lost their jobs. We paid billions in bailouts. We've lost trillions of dollars and lost retirement savings. So in response, the House and Senate have each passed a bill and then went to a conference committee.
Mm-hmm.
And this bill, which we can discuss, has significant changes to really hold Wall Street accountable in many ways and lay the basis for greater changes we can make in the future. Now, the bill is being voted on today in the House, and then it will wait during the recess, this July 4th recess, and then when we come back on July 13th or so, the Senate will then vote on it. So it's very important that everyone who's interested in really reforming Wall Street connect with their senators and tell them to vote for real reform.
So, I'd like to ask you about what you think of Senator Russ Feingold and what he was saying. He was saying that he's going to vote no on this financial reform bill, no matter how it comes out, because it did not put in the provisions about too big to fail, allowing banks to be made smaller, and safeguards that he thought should be in, like, the old Glass-Steagall kind of safeguards where they're doing the Depression to separate banks and the finance industry. What do you think of that stance, and what do you think of those critiques?
This is a remarkable bill. The bill has landmark consumer protection, protections that might in itself have helped to avoid the kind of crisis we saw where people faced scams that meant that there was almost fraud that was providing this subprime loans, where 60% of the people who received these subprime loans could have actually qualified for a conventional mortgage, but it wasn't offered to them. We will now have an independent consumer advocate working for the people and not just for the interests of the biggest banks. There also will be a light shined upon the shadow market. $600 trillion of derivatives will now be traded out in the open. It's been all secret in the past. And also we'll make sure that there's money to back up those reckless bets that have gone on before, and bringing much greater security to the economy as well as to the place where many of our pension funds are invested. And even in the questions of the separation of commercial and the risky investment banking, there is a greater separation that this bill will move towards. So this bill is significant, and people who are serious about working for Main Street will be voting for this bill. It is true that there are additional changes that are needed. We do need to address bank size, and there was an amendment that didn't pass that Ted Kaufman and Sherrod Brown introduced that would have addressed bank size directly, but both of them will be voting for this bill because they know that it makes such a significant impact on real reform. We know that there is additional changes that need to be made on foreclosure, but people who have been the leading foreclosure advocates, they're voting for this bill because they know that this bill is a significant basis for real financial reform. And those who are opposing this bill, whether they intend it or not, are standing with Wall Street and against Main Street. I am so saddened to hear what Senator Feingold is doing. He has been a great advocate on so many issues. But at this time, he is wrong voting against Main Street.
I understand Senator Cantwell might also stand against this bill.
Well, Senator Cantwell actually functioned quite differently from Senator Feingold. She fought and engaged and was deeply involved in trying to move for real reform at every step of the way. Later on today, we'll be meeting with her and discussing what the terms are. She's really been quite a champion to ensure that there's enforcement around the language around derivatives to make sure that there is money behind those bets that are made. And we think she has provided real leadership and was deeply engaged and wasn't just doing armchair philosophizing about what might be in a bill, but was actually creating the political change we wanted to see.
Now, I also understand, just before you and I got on the air here together today, this afternoon, that one of the things stripped out of the bill was the tax on banks and hedge funds that would have paid for some of this. Now, to talk a bit about that.
You know, that also, this is stunning. Senator Scott Brown, the man who said he came to the Senate in a pickup truck, it seems to have changed his pickup truck for a limousine, because he said he didn't want this additional assessment on the banks, the $19 billion that would have been assessed on the 30 largest banks, just the top banks, not all the banks, and the top hedge funds. But he didn't want that assessment. Now, he said it's because he thought that the tax, he'd called it a tax that would be passed on to the American public. But in fact, it was an assessment on the largest banks and the largest hedge funds. And because he had those concerns and because we were fearful of other Republicans picking up that charge, the conference committee reconvened yesterday and changed that ruling and said, okay, they won't make that as part of the bill, and instead they'll take this money out of the TARP funds and use that should there need to be funds to wind down one of these big financial institutions. So ironically, Scott Brown just gave a benefit to the largest banks, but that change is now in the bill, and we do hope now he still will decide with Main Street when the vote comes down after the recess.
What I found interesting about that, and then I want to get into more specifics about this bill and what it really does for this country and why you believe it's a step forward, is that Republicans like Senator Judd Gregg, of New Hampshire, was opposed to taxing the banks that we just talked about, but then kind of critiqued that this was pure deception of taxpayers because the TARP money is money that we are owed back from bailing out the banks. And in a sense, he's correct, but it seems like the Republicans are trying to have it both ways here.
I certainly think they are. You know, originally, the bill had something in it that we supported, which was a pre-funding by the banks for a bailout fund for a wind-down fund. So there'd be no more bailouts, but there'd be a pre-funding that all the biggest banks would have to pay into, and if any of them failed, they'd be dissolved. The board of directors would be forced out, and the banks, the largest financial institutions, would be broken up should they fail, so that there won't be any more bailouts. And the resolution, the breaking up those banks should they fail, that's in the current bill. But the pre-funding was in the original version. Well, what happened is when the Republicans heard about that, they started ad campaigns designed by their spinmeister, Frank Luntz, who said they should call it the Big Bank Bailout Bill. And so they ran ads, spending over $3 million to call this bill the Big Bank Bailout Bill, precisely because there'd be a pre-funding to wind down these banks. So the response was, okay, if that's really how you're going to play, we'll take that out. We won't give you an excuse for doing a whole media barrage around it. And they took that out. Now, that wasn't something, we didn't think that was the best policy to take it out, but we said, okay, if it's the if it's what's needed to get the rest of the bill through, we still think that it's a strong bill, and these banks will be wound down without bailouts in the future. So then we had to find a way to pay for this this bill overall in order that it be revenue neutral. And that's where they came up with this assessment on the banks. And then again, some of the Republicans also raised concerns about that. The thing that's a tragedy is this should be a nonpartisan, it should be a bipartisan bill. This should be what everyone should support. And we hope that Senators Collins and Snow, we hope Senator Brown from Massachusetts, we when it passed the Senate. Senator Grassley also supported it, and we hope all of those who want to stand with Main Street will end up in support of this bill.
Politically, it's interesting what you just said. And by the way, we are talking with Heather Booth, who is Executive Director of Americans for Financial Prosperity. Reform.
Right.
And lest you think this is one-sided, the Americans for Prosperity are supposed to join this discussion, a much more conservative group, but they haven't called in yet. If they do, we'll have them join this conversation.
We'd love to be in a discussion with them. We think this is something that everyone should join on to.
Exactly. And so we were hoping that they were going to join us. We don't know what happened. But if they do get in touch, we'll have them join in the middle of this conversation. What you just said, it is true politically in this country. What's interesting about this thing, the anger of Wall Street, is that it crosses the spectrum from conservative, moderate, liberal, progressive. I mean, it goes all the way across in terms of this anger. And it's kind of odd that the partisan politics of the Republican Party seeming to play this against Barack Obama, setting up for the elections, is taking precedent over the kind of really disgruntledness of the American people around financial reform.
Well, we really think that that's a tragedy. We think that there are several things going on about why would anyone vote against a bill that would provide real consumer protection? Why would anyone vote against a bill that will say that hedge funds and private equity, which have been so risky and undermined so many companies, why would they vote for the registration of those investments? Why would anyone not be for the kind of mortgage reforms that are in this bill that would say that you can't make loans to people to borrowers who can't repay? And it bans kickbacks for steering people into high-rate loans when they qualify for lower rates. Or there are investor protections. There are shareholder protections. There's so many benefits in this bill. Why would anyone vote against it? There's some who might want to say, well, I want to see it even stronger, but I'll vote for this as a good start. One reason they might vote against it is if, in fact, their whole life is in the hedge funds and private equity, and they're making the millions of dollars in the excess bonuses of Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and these other large financial institutions. So that's one reason. Or they may be political leaders who've been getting money from those large financial institutions. You know, there's 3,000 people lobbying for the financial industry in order to destroy this legislation or undermine it and weaken it. The financial industry has spent $1 million for every member of Congress in order to weaken this bill. They spend over $1.4 million a day to defeat reform. So there are reasons people might vote against it, that they either are in the industry, that they're kind of a front group for the industry, or they've been getting money from them, and so they see their perspective and want to vote their way. But this should be a bill because it helps so much of America, and it really will start to help put us back on the right track. Everyone should really support it.
What do you think has happened, though? I mean, that was one of the big bogeymen that everybody talked about in terms of this bill and the danger that it would not really reach even to the point that it's reached today because of the power and the wealth of the banking lobby. But something happened. What do you think happened?
To do what? Something happened to...
That something allowed even the bill with what many on the progressive end would consider its flaws by not being able to break up big banks, not by having the firewall between commercial investment banking in there and the other issues. But those were battled back and stopped. But
why the bill is not even stronger? Well, but here's how change happens. Change happens as the public becomes aware and engaged and sees that there's something that they can do about a particular problem. And so you make steps towards change, you gain confidence and realize you can do battle. David can win sometimes against Goliath, and then you take on other challenges. In 1964, when there was a Civil Rights Act, we still needed a Voting Rights Act in 1965. We needed to improve on that. And we still needed Fair Housing Act in 1968 or in 1970 when the Environmental Protection Agency Act was passed. We still needed a Clean Water Act in 1972, And we still needed toxic waste and other acts as the years went on, and we still need more even now. We need new ways to serve the American public, and each change can build for another one. What happened with this bill was that it started out very weak, and while the public was furious about the financial crisis, neither the politicians and some of the public wasn't paying attention to the specific legislative reform. We had other things on the agenda. Health care was up, and that's really where the political attention was focused. After health care was passed, there were a series of hearings. Carl Levin held a hearing, an oversight committee in the Senate, and in exposing Goldman Sachs as having had this incredible conflict of interest of selling these derivatives, these credit default swaps, saying that the price of housing will go up. Well, they were betting that the price of housing would go down. And as people became aware of it, and there was an Securities and Exchange Commission suit that came up, people's attention refocused. Healthcare moved on. The president refocused. He provided a speech. We started organizing. And so the bill that was introduced in the House became even stronger as it moved to the Senate. Not usually what happens, even against all the power of the lobbyists. But the American people were paying attention. And then it moved from the Senate into this conference committee. And one concern we've got right now is that with the delay of this recess, people's minds may be on other things. It's certainly a wonderful July 4th holiday that we hope people are celebrating, but there are other great difficulties. Our attention is on, from Afghanistan to the oil crisis in the Gulf to other problems of daily life. And if people are not focusing their attention on this problem, that's when the big banks win. In the secrecy of back rooms, in the deals that aren't made, where there is visibility in events like your radio show and other kinds of promotion. So we're asking people to become involved.
Let me walk through some of this, what happened here and what we got and what we didn't get. Let's talk about the Consumer Protection Agency. That was a big battle, and originally that was taken out, and then it was put into put under the Fed, and the argument whether that would be independent or not. Where is this ending up now in this debate in terms of the Consumer Protection Agency?
Well, what we've won is an agency that is independent of the big banks and of the regulators of the big banks. It's led by a director appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Now, it's housed in the Federal Reserve,
right?
But it's not subservient to it.
How's that?
So we would have wanted it as a standalone agency, but in fact, you can have one agency inside another if it's sort of its mailing address, but it's not. It's not the owner, just like the FBI really does have independence. And so there, it's very strong. It's even landmark, is what the major consumer groups in the country believe. It means that when you get a mortgage, you'll be able to understand the terms of what's included. When you get your credit card, your credit card bill, you'll understand what these rates are going to be, and there won't really be this kind of fraud that's gone on before. Now, there were places we'd like it to have been stronger. There was a carve-out for auto dealers, and we think that shouldn't have happened. We fought it. But we feel there are other strengths that will give consumers real protections as we move on.
So and then on this the one of the biggest issues of the day, and I'd like you to talk to our listeners about how this ended up and what the pros and cons were and where we still may have to go on the huge issue of derivatives, which is what caused this crisis that we face financially to begin with.
Right. Well, these are a $600 trillion market. It's more than the whole U.S. economy, and they're bets. They're bets and insurance on bets, often done without any money to back it up. 90% of that market in the U.S. is really controlled by five big financial institutions, almost all unregulated previously. And by being unregulated with no rules and no one minding the store, it meant that we didn't know how many bets were going through any one institution, and it's that now will be changed because now they will go through trading exchanges, just like the stock exchange. So you'll know they'll be regulated. You'll know what the cost of these trades are, and it will be open information. The second thing is, in the past, it wasn't clear that when the bets were made that there was any money to back up the bets. It's like if you went to Las Vegas and said, give me $100 of chips, but I'm not going to give you the money. Just trust me. And one of the reasons that AIG failed, spiraling so much of the problems we're facing, is because there were enormous bets going through it that weren't good bets, and there was no money to back it up. And that also will be changed. So those are very significant changes. Now, Senator Cantwell also fought for enforcement on these rules, mm-hmm. and the changes that she wants have been fully incorporated. In fact, even more has been incorporated. We did want a full separation between these derivative swap exchange desks within the large financial institutions, and we wanted all of them spun off from the large financial institutions that we thought they could be in a fully capitalized, fully financially supported subsidiary of the large institution. And we got part of the way there, and that's an issue we'll have to take on in the future. As I think you'll see from what I just said, very significant progress has been made.
Now, the one of the other major issues in this bill is this Volcker rule. Explain the Volcker rule and what's happened to that in this bill and where we stand with it.
The Volcker rule means that banks don't get to make risky bets from their own accounts, and because they own their own money, this is unlike a trade being made for someone else, a secondary party. They're called proprietary trading. So what Paul Volcker had wanted in the Volcker rule was to separate the proprietary risky trading from the commercial banking and to have the full separation. It wasn't in the House at all. And in the Senate-passed version, it was then combined with language from Senators Merkley and Levin that would make it statutory. The original Volcker rule was just going to be advisory, and there'd be a study, and then it would be implemented. Now it's been made statutory, and is going to be made much, much firmer, and it goes some of the way to the separation of dealing even with these too-big-to-fail institutions. So it does something really about bank size indirectly. What was unfortunate is Senator Scott Brown from Massachusetts was able to win a special interest carve-out that allowed banks to use the private equity and hedge funds up to 3% of the bank capital, and also investing up to no more than 3% of the specific fund they're investing in. So this was something we opposed. Senator Brown wanted it, particularly because he was trying to defend State Street Bank in Massachusetts. But I'd say even on this, it's a significant victory, and it's something that moves us much more in the direction of dealing with these too-big-to-fail institutions, though more still needs to be done.
Well, when you say more needs to be done, let me ask you about that, and then I have one more question. I'll let you run to your next meeting. But one of the things that this bill, as many people would argue, is a step forward, and it, in terms of the battle that took place with the banking lobby, many people are amazed that this bill is as strong as it is. And got to the places that it has gotten. But when you look at some of the critique of the bill, and one of the things, again, that Russ Feingold and others were saying about the bill was that this bill, the way it's set up, does not prevent another catastrophe from taking place that really hasn't taken place in a level like this since the Great Depression, that without something like a Glass-Steagall that separates the commercial and financial and investment industry, investment banking, that's a tremendous weakness. And when the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act passed in the 90s, it repealed Glass-Steagall. It kind of opened the way for this conglomeration of wealth in the world and the concentration of financial assets and the creation of what we now call too-big-to-fail firms. So since that's not and the fact that the percentage of our GDP that banks now make and own, I think the largest six banks, our assets are now equal to more than 60% of our gross domestic product. That those things, these things are huge, and they're difficult for sometimes for us to put our hands around. But those things are looming, and they're very large, and I think that has to be understood in light of what was passed, what may be passed.
Enormous progress has been made, and the exact kind of crisis that we had won't happen again if this bill is passed. There are other problems that still need to be addressed, but just again, remember the changes that will be in place if this bill was passed that contributed to the current crisis. The fraud that allowed the subprime loans, especially targeting low-income and communities of color, that subprime crisis would not exist with a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, someone really looking out for the consumers. The investment in the speculation that allowed it to spiral out of into the stratosphere with AIG and others taking these bets that were based on faulty information and misleading, consciously misleading information, that will now be out in the open. There'll be money to back up that those investments, and we'll know about what's at stake. Many of them also have now been, will be spun off even into capitalized subsidiaries, and there will be a separation between the proprietary trading and the commercial banking, so that we've made enormous steps in this direction. Plus, there will now be some ways to have more of a say about who are the boards of directors of these organizations, of these large corporations. That this has been for 10 years or more, there have been shareholder groups trying to fight for that, so that the boards of directors just can't get away with whatever they want. There'll be some revision on credit rating agencies, holding them somewhat more accountable. We'll be opening up the Federal Reserve books, at least to do an audit of what happened this last time, and it lays the basis for additional changes, really for a democratization of the Fed, which is needed, that we'll move for in the future. So that the exact elements that caused this crisis, they are being addressed by this bill. It's true that history doesn't repeat itself exactly. There are new problems we can anticipate. There's some current problems that haven't yet been addressed. The foreclosure crisis, prime amongst them. Our own view in Americans for Financial Reform is that there should be a serious tax on speculation, financial speculation tax that, by the way, could raise an enormous amount of money as well as limit this kind of speculation. We could raise $100 billion a year to invest in people who've lost their jobs and clean up the environment in the Gulf Coast and provide health care for all. So there are a number of things we still need to do. But this is an extraordinary basis on which we can build. And the banks have been fighting it because they know that it will rein in some of the reckless activities. We've come this far because people organized. We had 5,000 people in Chicago with the American Bankers Association. We had 10,000 on Wall Street. We had several thousand in Washington, D.C., and at hundreds of banks around the country. And this is a time we can jointly take action. During this July 4th recess, we need to convince our senators, vote for real reform. Don't stand with Wall Street. Stand with Main Street. And if we fight together, we really can win a much better future.
Heather Booth, Executive Director of Americans for Financial Reform, thank you so much for taking your time with us, and we look forward to seeing what happens after the 4th.
And thanks very much for the time on the show. Thanks for all you're doing.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.